Announcement quick. There are two sheets for the Mara Makomos. So if you only have one, there are two different ones for the speech. Good evening, everybody. And welcome to the first of many exciting events to be hosted by Yeshiva University's new Medical Ethics Society. With rapid advancements in modern science, we are now capable of doing things that only before was science fiction. However, does the fact that we can do something necessarily mean that we should do it? Healthcare professionals in all fields are constantly faced with ethical issues. As human beings, we are charged to behave ethically. But as Jews, our higher calling beckons us to face the challenging issues. Do we have the right to play God? Can we abort pregnancies? Can we exploit human stem cell potential? Or can we decide the fate of a terminally ill patient? What are the halachos of a doctor on Shabbat? With such pressing needs, the need to address these issues in medical ethics, and with the largest percentage in the country of Jewish pre-health students at YU, we felt that YU should serve as the Center for Jewish Medical Ethics. With no current program in YU, the Medical Ethics Society aims to fill that void. Over the course of the year, we hope to offer a wide variety of exciting programming. As part of our goal of ongoing education, we offer a series of monthly shiurim given by a local rav or a member of the kollel. Myra McComa will be emailed out about a week before. The shiurim will generally take place Thursday during club hour. And basically the idea is, for those who are interested, you can go more in depth from the source sheets in a more personal setting. Another one of our initiatives is our university-wide lecture series, which we plan to host an array of experts in the field of medical ethics. We hope to benefit from their wisdom, their firsthand experience, and learn from the breadth of their knowledge. Topics to look forward to include abortion, organ donation, euthanasia, fertility, medical malpractice, health of medicine on Shabbat, as well as genetic engineering, contraception, and sex selection. Each of our lectures will raise our awareness in the issues and heighten our ethical senses to deal with the challenges they present. Learning about medical ethics is one thing, but seeing medical ethics in action firsthand is another. Through our program, Medical Ethics in Action, we are planning field trips to clinics and other places where medical ethics affect people on a day-to-day life. More information will be forthcoming in our emails. At the culmination of our year-long initiatives, we plan to play an active role in coordinating an international medical ethics conference that might be hosted here at YU. The conference will bring together a wide range of experts from all different perspectives in the field. We also hope to host our own conference as well, open to medical professionals in the field. And we hope to send a delegation of club members to represent YU at Princeton University's annual International Bioethics Conference. With a unique relationship with CJF and a power-packed advisory board that includes Dr. Fred Rosner, Rabbi Dr. Edward Reichman, and Rabbi Kenneth Brander, we look forward to taking the advantage of our very unique opportunities. We hope that you too will take advantage of our various programs throughout the course of the year. There's no need for a long-term commitment, as it seems that we're doing a lot, but each event is independent of each other, so you can pick and choose to fit your schedule and your interests. But please, there are lists going around. If you can sign your name and your email address, that'd be great. I would just like to take a moment and extend a hearty thanks to our board members who have met about once a week and worked hard on getting us off the ground and getting this event together. Our Vice President David Stern, who actually wasn't able to be here tonight, our Treasurer Michael Derahim, our Secretary Aaron Etra, over there, our Shear Program Chair Josh Craw, and our board members T.V. Steinberger, Menachem Yandorf, and Michael Teicher, as well as to our Stern co-directors Elisheva Levine and Zahava Sinensky. They have really helped us make the society what it is today. I would also like to make a very special thank you to Rabbi Josh Joseph, who has led us in every step of the way and devoted his time and energy in helping us create what we have. I would also like to thank our sponsors, Center for the Jewish Future, Torah Motto Lecture Series, and Yeshiva College Student Association. And now, we are pleased to present our inaugural lecture featuring Rabbi Dr. Edward Reichman. Rabbi Dr. Reichman is an associate professor of emergency medicine at Montefiore Medical Center and an associate professor of philosophy and history of medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University, where he teaches Jewish medical ethics. He received his rabbinic ordination from Reitz, Yeshiva University, and writes and lectures widely in the field of Jewish medical ethics. In addition, Dr. Reichman now works with the CJF in a new initiative here on campus called Machom Pua, which is a program to train young rabbis from here, from the Kollel, and from Reitz, in the halachos of science of fertility and infertility. This is something that requires mastering both the halacha and the science, and only one man was actually able to do that, and that was Dr. Reichman. Please lend a warm welcome to Dr. Reichman.
Thank you very much, Yona, for that hyperbolic introduction. I am very honored to be here tonight, and I'm very excited to be here tonight as part of this extraordinary initiative. I tell you, if I would have been so lucky to be in Yeshiva College when all these things would have been going on, I would have been very happy. Just listening to the proposed ideas that he has and the opportunities that he has to learn about the interface of medicine and halacha is really exciting and inspiring, and I'm sure he's going to bring many of these things to fruition, and I look forward, Mir Hashem, to being a part of it. When Yona gave the introduction, he mentioned a number of areas. He mentioned abortion, end-of-life issues, stem cell research. Every single one of these could be and probably will be a topic of discussion in this forum or in other fora throughout the course of the year. And we live in quite an extraordinary age, very unique age. Such an age people have never lived in before. We can control reproduction in ways we've never controlled reproduction before. We have genetics and genetic testing, understanding the human body, the Human Genome Project. We have transplantation of body parts. We have a whole host of areas which have given us tremendous understanding about the human being, which we've never had before. To such an extent that a scientist has actually had the audacity to approach God and say, God, I'm not so sure we need you anymore. We can do just about everything you can do. We can even create man, just like you did at the beginning. So God turns to the scientist and said, is that so? How do you do such a thing? So the scientist said, well, we take some dirt from the ground, and we take it to the laboratory, and we blow some air into it, and we use a pipette. So God said, that sounds very interesting. Why don't you show me? So the scientist proceeds to bend down and pick up the dirt, and God says, no, no, no. You get your own dirt. Despite the fact that scientists believe that they control everything, we, as Torah-observant Jews, are fully aware of the fact that there's a God above that divines everything. And I commend you all for realizing that and coming to this kind of lecture and, in Yirtzeh Hashem, other lectures like this in the future. Now, my objective this evening is to cover but one topic, one of many we could have covered. One very fascinating topic on truly the cutting edge of science and on the understanding of the very essence of the human being. And to address that topic, I want to take a step back for just a few moments. And I think it's very important for us to have at least a brief historical appreciation and context of the world of medical halacha and the world of science before we propel ourselves forward into the 21st century. And I ask you to take in your hand the handout entitled Smallpox Inoculation. By a show of hands, how many people in this room have ever seen a case of smallpox? Anybody? Not a single hand goes up in this room. If I were to ask this question, or would have asked this question in the 1700s or the early 1800s, it would have been a ridiculous question. Because every single person in this room would know somebody or personally have smallpox. And in fact, the disease smallpox, which nobody here has seen, in the 17th and 18th centuries was endemic in Europe and was such a plague that some statisticians maintain that more people died from the disease smallpox in the history of mankind than any other cause of death, including wars and including other causes, medical causes of death. So you can well imagine in the 1700s, when a potential cure came on the horizon to treat this disease which was afflicting millions of people, and especially and particularly children, there was tremendous excitement in the medical community. And what was that cure that was on the horizon at that time in the 1700s? It was a procedure called inoculation. Now, what was inoculation? Inoculation was taking an individual who suffered from the disease smallpox. Now, pox is like chicken pox. It was pox, little vesicles, little bumps all over the skin which contained fluid. And what they suggested at that time is that one would remove a little bit of fluid from somebody who suffered from the disease smallpox, and then they would take that piece of fluid, or that little bit of fluid, and inject it into somebody who was healthy in the hopes of exposing them to a mild form of the disease and not to the fatal form of the disease. And in fact, this was an effective treatment for the disease smallpox. Now, what was the problem? The problem was there was a small percentage of chance that by infecting this individual with smallpox, they would die as a result of smallpox. And in fact, on your handout, in the middle right-hand side, there's a gravestone from not too far from here, Huntington, Long Island, which reads, in memory of Peleg, son of Thomas and Mary Conklin, who died of the smallpox by inoculation, January 27, 1788, aged 17 years old. A healthy boy who received an inoculation and died as a result of the inoculation. And lest you think for a moment that smallpox was not afflicting the Jewish community, we have a treatise on the upper left-hand corner from 1785, from Avram Nansich, who lost two children to the disease smallpox and begged the rabbis of his time to address the halachic issues of this new smallpox inoculation. So what you have in essence is in the 1700s a very contemporary halachic dilemma. Millions of people, including Jews and Jewish children, dying from the disease smallpox, and a new cure on the horizon. And poskim at that time had to deal with the halachic issues of this cure. Now, what was so unique about this cure? What halachic problems did it present? The halachic problem that it presented was the following. According to our tradition, and you may have lectures on this topic as well, the Torah teaches us virapo yirape. A physician has a license to heal, and what the extent of that license is a matter of intense debate from the Middle Ages until today. But the license is to heal somebody who's sick. Does the Torah give you a right to take somebody who's otherwise healthy, which is the case with smallpox inoculation, and inject them with a disease which could cause their death? Perhaps halacha does not allow you to do such a thing. So you have a great halachic dilemma in the 1700s. How is this dilemma answered? This dilemma was answered in exactly the same methodology that we are going to employ today in our discussion about stem cell research, and in the exact methodology which is employed in every medical halachic question since the inception of halacha. And this is why it's so essential for you to start the learning process as early as possible. When you address a medical halachic question, you must understand in its entirety the medicine involved in the question. And that means if your question is in 1785, you have to understand the medicine of 1785. If your question is in 2005, you have to understand the medicine in 2005. Then and only then, armed with an understanding of the science and the medicine, which requires dialogue with scientists and physicians, then you can answer the halachic question properly. So you see in your upper right-hand corner a response to this dilemma in the 18th century, which is excerpted from the Tiferes Yisrael, the Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz commentary on the Mishnah in Yoma. Reading from the second line, test your ability to read. Umizeh nira li heter la'asos inoculation shel pakin. The Tiferes Yisrael was addressing a very real and contemporary medical halachic problem. Therefore, based on the foregoing analysis, which you don't have before you, the Tiferes Yisrael concluded it was permissible to use smallpox inoculation. Why? Af she'echad me'elef meis al yedeho inoculation. Even though, based on his medical understanding and dialogue with physicians, there was a 1 in 1,000 chance that someone would indeed die as a result of inoculation. Al kol panim she'mishavu bo hapakim hativiim hasakana krova yoser. If you contract the spontaneous form of smallpox, which was endemic in Europe, your odds of death are much higher. L'chein rashai lachnis es atzmo v'sakana rechoka kedei lahatzil es atzmo me'sakana krova. Therefore, you are allowed to endanger yourself or incur a limited risk in order to protect yourself from greater danger. Now, here you have but one example, and there are countless examples in previous centuries, of poskim dealing with what were very real, contemporary, pressing halachic problems. And the answer to this question meant the possibility of saving thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives. This was no small shiloh. Shift forward now to the 21st century. We're now on the horizon of a potential treatment which, again, could save thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps millions of lives. The promise of stem cell research, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. Our objective today, as we turn now to our other handout, our second handout, our objective this evening is to do the exact same thing that's been done for centuries. First, understand the science of stem cell research. And stem cell research is particularly complicated. Not everybody understands exactly what a stem cell is, where a stem cell comes from, what types of stem cells there are, what the halachic issues or even the scientific issues are that relate to stem cell research. So we are first and foremost going to spend a few moments on the science of stem cell research. Once we understand the science of stem cell research, then we can begin to address the issue from a halachic perspective. So since I knew I was going to be talking about stem cells today, I actually have a treat for you. I brought some stem cells with me. Now, if you look very closely, you'll see I have stem cells right over here. I have some stem cells over here. And I even have stem cells over here. And indeed, every single person in this room has stem cells. There are stem cells in your hearts, there are stem cells in your brains, and there are stem cells in your bone marrow. Are these the stem cells that everybody's talking about? Or are there different stem cells that everybody's talking about? So let's begin at the beginning. If you look in your upper left-hand corner, you'll see the meeting of the male reproductive seed and the female reproductive seed. At that stage of fertilization, when that occurs, the cell begins to divide. At the initial stages, in its two-cell stage and its four-cell stage, each single cell has the potential to become a full human being. And if you separated those cells and implanted them into a woman's womb, each would become a cloned, identical human being. But if you allow the cell to continue to grow, after a few more divisions, the cells begin to differentiate, and a mass or cluster of cells in the right-hand side forms, and that cluster of cells are called stem cells. Now, each one of these stem cells cannot become a full human being, but at this stage in the embryological development, each one of these stem cells can become every possible organ system. So every stem cell has the potential to become a liver, a lung, a brain, a kidney, bone marrow. Now, what decides that cell A will become brain, and cell B will become bone, and cell C will become heart, cardiac muscle, is what makes an understanding of embryology a segue to faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How it's possible for this mass of cells that all look identical to become people sitting in this room is an extraordinary act that, if you learn embryology, I dare say it's impossible not to believe in a God. It's just absolutely extraordinary. It is these cluster of cells, these so-called stem cells, and these are called embryonic stem cells, that scientists wish to harness to be able to guide them into different organ systems to potentially treat human disease. The problem is, to harvest these stem cells, perforce you must destroy the embryo. If you don't destroy the embryo, you can't access the cells. If you remove the cells, that embryo is no longer a viable embryo. You can't subsequently implant that embryo or use it for anything else. You have to destroy the embryo. Therein lies the legal, ethical, and halachic dilemma. As we continue along the pathway, stem cells can also be harvested in other developmental stages. So once a child begins to grow, even in the uterus, and a woman has, for example, a spontaneous miscarriage or an abortion, stem cells can be harvested from the fetus and can also be used. But these stem cells are not the embryonic stem cells, which could potentially become every organ system. These are stem cells which have begun to differentiate and become associated with specific organ systems. And as you continue along the embryological pathway, some of you may be familiar with the concept of harvesting umbilical cord blood from women who are in the delivery room. Now, what is umbilical cord blood good for? Umbilical cord blood contains stem cells, but these are not embryonic stem cells. These are blood stem cells which can only be used to generate blood, the blood organs. That's all. The red cells and the white cells, etc. And just to give you an idea of the extraordinary advances in technology, I'll share with you one of the potential uses of umbilical cord stem cells. There was a case about 10, 15 years ago, maybe a little less, of a family who had a child that suffered from a disease, a blood-borne disease. And the only treatment for that disease was bone marrow transplant. Now, in order to be a bone marrow donor and to match, you need to have certain aspects of your genetics that match. There has to be an HLA match, it's called. So they searched the entire world in all the databases, and there was nobody that could serve as a match. Now, each family member has each child that they have has a 1 in 4 chance to match the sibling. And their existing children did not match this child that had this blood-borne disease, which is fatal. So what they decided to do, what the couple decided to do, is they decided to conceive a child in the natural way in the hopes that the child that would be born would be a donor for their existing sibling who suffered from that disease. And lo and behold, as Hashgacha would have it, they hit the jackpot. They hit that 1 in 4 chance. And the child that they conceived naturally was indeed a match. And after the child was born, They harvested bone marrow from that child, and they transplanted it into the child who had the problem, and the child was cured. But now, technology has evolved since that time. Now we don't have to leave it up to chance. Now, with the following technology, it's possible to make certain that you have a donor. And what is this technology? This technology is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, a topic which may be in a future lecture, one of the most exciting areas of modern medicine and the most ethically complicated. I sat on a committee in Washington to advise the politicians on possible ways to use this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and we spent months on the applications of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. With this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, you can determine with 100% certainty the genetic makeup of the embryo. So about a year or two ago, a couple in London had a child who suffered from Fanconi's anemia, a fatal disease. Again, no existing bone marrow donor. So they went to the laboratory, harvested his sperm and her eggs, fertilized a number of embryos to create a number of embryos in the laboratory, tested the embryos until they found an exact HLA match to the existing child, implanted that into the mother's womb. That woman carried the child for 9 months. In the delivery room, they harvested umbilical cord stem cells from the umbilical cord of the baby, extracted those cells, transplanted them into the individual who suffered from Fanconi's anemia, and completely cured his condition. Absolutely extraordinary application of the stem cells of the umbilical cord. But there are also stem cells that I mentioned that are in each and every one of us. And it has been thought until now, and the science is evolving, that once a brain stem cell becomes a brain stem cell, it stays a brain stem cell. And once a cardiac stem cell becomes a cardiac stem cell, it stays that way. But now, scientists are working on ways to de-differentiate the cells, to trick those cells into believing or turning the clock back so that a brain cell may be able to become a kidney cell or may be able to become a blood cell. And this is the evolving science that each of us in this room will hopefully be beneficiaries of as time evolves. So these are the types of stem cells, but what are the possible uses of these stem cells? We have the embryonic stem cells, the fetal stem cells, the umbilical cord stem cells, the adult stem cells as you reach up the embryological ladder. But what's the use of all these stem cells? And where, by the way, do these stem cells come from? Where does one harvest these stem cells? So there are a number of sources of harvesting these stem cells. One of the most fertile sources, if you will, is the banks across the country, across the world, that treat women for infertility and men for infertility. In the process of infertility, many people harvest eggs and sperm and create fertilized embryos. There are, as we sit here, tens of thousands of embryos sitting in laboratories throughout the world that are potential sources for harvesting these embryonic stem cells. But there's another source as well, and that's on the top of your handout. Scientists cloned human embryos. It is possible to use the cloning technology as a way of harvesting embryos. And what is cloning technology? And I'll discuss it here, and we'll discuss in a moment the potential applications of the marriage of cloning and stem cell research. Again, remarkable possibilities. But cloning, very simply, obviates the need to use reproductive cells of the male. What do you do in the cloning procedure? We still require the use of an egg. So you would harvest the egg of a woman, clean out all the DNA from that egg, then inject a full set of chromosomes into that egg from any cell of the human body and from either male or female. And in that process, when they do that, then they trick that cell into believing it's an embryonic cell, and that cell suddenly begins to divide. And it divides, and there was a paper that just came out today, as a matter of fact, when I was browsing the web at work. There's a paper that came out that once a cell is cloned like this, there was a concern that the development of that cloned cell might proceed very different to the normal fertilized cell. And research that just came out today from the scientist maintains that there is indeed not much embryological difference in the growth of a cloned egg once it begins to divide and a regular fertilized egg once it begins to divide. So that's another potential source of these stem cells. But what can they be used for? In the next paragraph on your handout, researchers develop human blood cells. How many people here have ever been to a blood drive? The Red Cross is always crying, they don't have enough blood. Every shul throughout the country has blood drives in order to make sure that the blood banks are filled with blood. So imagine the following scenario. The laboratory harvests stem cells from every possible blood type and guides those stem cells to become blood cells. And if they need AB negative blood, they simply create more in the laboratory. They need A positive blood, they simply create more in the laboratory. The whole concept of blood donation will be a thing of the past, be rendered irrelevant. Is this science fiction or is this scientific fact? Only time will tell. The next paragraph, how many diabetics are there in this country? Millions of people suffering from diabetes. Every drug company in this country is trying to find an effective cure for diabetes. Do you give insulin? Do you give it by injection? Do you give it intranasally? Do you give it orally? Do you give it, how many times a day do you give it? Do you give it via pump? Tremendously difficult disease to control, disease which affects millions of Americans. Imagine this scenario, and this is on the horizon. Take stem cells, guide the stem cells to create pancreatic cells or cells that produce insulin. And you do not even need to inject those cells into the pancreas. You can simply put them under the skin and your blood supply could regulate the production of insulin so that you will be able to create your own insulin and thereby cure patients that are suffering from diabetes. Transplanted tissue could offer a solution to kidney shortage. How many people in this world are suffering from kidney failure? I just had a tragic case today. One of the patients that I was treating in the emergency department came in with kidney failure and very tragically died in the emergency department from kidney failure. Every single day there are tragedies from kidney failure. Imagine this scenario. You could create from stem cells either partial organs or complete organs and use those for transplantation. Now one of the topics which I'm sure will be covered during the year or the coming years is organ transplantation. There are thousands of people a year that die awaiting organs. If you could create organs or substitute organs from stem cells, that would render the entire waiting list irrelevant. People wouldn't have to wait for organs anymore. People wouldn't have to die on lists. They could simply be created in laboratories. And this next one is even more exciting, from the Technion. Technion creates natural pacemakers for pigs. And I'll have you know, by the way, that Israel is on the frontier of stem cell research, and many of the exciting developments are occurring in Israel. Research at the Technion are the first to create contracting heart cells from embryonic stem cells and successfully transplant them into pig hearts so that they function as biological pacemakers. Lest you think that this is not clinical. They created from stem cells, they created cardiac muscle, and I've seen the video footage of this, it's fascinating, and the cardiac muscle actually pumps, which is absolutely extraordinary. And they transplanted it into pigs, and it's been incorporated into the pig heart muscle. So imagine you have a patient with a heart attack, and this patient, I saw a patient with a heart attack again today, not too many hours ago. There's very little, there's many things we can do for heart attacks. But imagine if I could take stem cells and inject stem cells into that patient's cardiac muscle and he could regenerate new cardiac muscle. So the heart, which normally pumps well, after a heart attack starts to pump very poorly. If I could create new heart muscle and regenerate, a person could live a long, healthy life. Tremendous potential. Parkinson's disease, again in Israel. Rats with Parkinson's improve after Israeli stem cell transplant. Parkinson's disease plagues millions of people in the country. Researchers became the first in the world to show that human embryonic stem cells can improve the functioning of rats with Parkinson's disease. There is a particular neurotransmitter called dopamine, which people with Parkinson's disease are deficient in. If you can guide stem cells to create this dopamine and inject those either directly into the brain or to other parts of the body to supply that missing neurotransmitter, you could potentially cure Parkinson's disease. So you see here, the potential is truly extraordinary. And these others on the second page, I'll let you read. But I just want to share with you, as I mentioned a few moments ago, or alluded to, the potential marriage of stem cell research and cloning, and what the possible clinical applications there are. So imagine this scenario. Today, in 2005, despite our tremendous advances in the fields of transplantation medicine, it is still essential for anybody who receives a transplant to take certain medicines. Why? Because when any human being receives as a transplant a foreign organ, albeit from another human being, your body doesn't recognize that. Just like your body doesn't recognize a virus or recognize a bacteria and begins to attack it, your immune system begins to attack it immediately upon exposure. The same thing is true if your body receives a heart from another human being or a kidney from another human being. So what have physicians done to prevent your body from rejecting that organ? They've created medicines called immunosuppressive medicines, which by its very name means suppress the immune system. So it prevents your body from attacking that organ that you receive and allows you to live with that organ. What happens, though, when you suppress the immune system? You're not only suppressing your possibility of rejecting the heart, you're suppressing your ability to reject anything that your body sees. So if transplant patients in Montefiore, where I work, is a kidney transplant center and a cardiac transplant center, and we see many of these kinds of patients, if a transplant patient has a cold that you and I would not think twice about, and they have a fever of 102, they're at the hospital immediately. Because even the most minor bacterial infection in a patient who has a suppressed immune system can be fatal. So still, in 2005, to maintain an organ, you have to take that medicine your entire life and never stop. And if you stop, your body will reject the organ. So what's on the potential horizon? Imagine an individual who suffers from heart disease. He needs a heart transplant. They take a cell from his body and clone it. In that clone cell, once the clone starts to differentiate, they harvest the stem cells from that clone cell, guide those stem cells to produce, it's a little science fiction to say they'll produce an entire heart, a freestanding heart, but at least they'll produce cardiac muscle. And that we see they've already done in Israel. And you re-implant that heart tissue into the individual. Now how is he going to view those cells? Are those cells foreign or are those cells considered self? Those cells are self. Those are his own genes. It's a clone of his own cell. So in theory, one could transplant this clone tissue into the individual and he would not need to take immunosuppressive medicines because his body wouldn't reject it. Now here we don't know if this will be a reality, if this will be science fiction, or if this will be scientific fact. But again, the potential is obviously absolutely extraordinary. So what then, now that we understand the science, we understand where stem cells come from, how we can harvest stem cells, what the source from the from embryos in the laboratory or from cloning procedures, we understand the potential uses for stem cells. What does halacha now have to say about the stem cell? So the adult stem cells that we talked about, and even the umbilical cord stem cells we talked about, very little halachic issues. There are no prohibitions, there are no isurim, there's no problems with using those kinds of stem cells for research, and quite the contrary, we'd strongly recommend it, urge it in the fullest form. So what is the halachic problem? The halachic problem is harvesting stem cells from the pre-embryo, from the embryo which we must destroy. And the essence of the question is, what is the halachic status of the stem cell? Is a stem cell just a stem cell, if you will? So in order to answer this question, I'd like to present to you the following case. And this is a real case, but I varied some of the details for our discussion. In Tel Aviv, about a year or two ago, there was a fertility clinic which housed 500 frozen embryos. And lo and behold, it was Shabbos. And the electricity went out in the building. And there was potential that these 500 embryos that hundreds of couples had spent countless effort, emotional effort, physiological effort, financial effort to produce, were at risk of decomposing. I don't want to say at risk of dying, because that implies that there's life involved. That's precisely the question. Is there life? Is there not life? So they run to the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and he's in the middle of Musaf. Said, "Rabbi, we have to interrupt you. This is a serious Shiloh. Life or death Shiloh. Are we allowed to be Mechal Shabbos? Can we violate Shabbos to preserve these 500 embryos sitting in the laboratory?" How many people think the answer to that is yes? How many people think no? So the answer to that will give us a window into the halachic view of the halachic status of the pre-embryo. So let's not move back, let's move forward a little bit. If, God forbid, somebody in this room on Shabbos has a medical emergency, and maybe you said Hilchos Shabbos is one of the things that the Yoni wants to address. We'll start with basic Hilchos Shabbos over here. If somebody has a medical, potentially life-threatening emergency on Shabbos, are you allowed to violate Shabbos to save that person's life? Are we agreed on that? Why are we allowed to do that? What's the halachic principle? Pikuach nefesh. You're allowed to save a soul, save a life. Now let me ask you this question. A woman who is pregnant with a seventh-month fetus, and the woman is fine, but her seventh-month fetus is at risk of losing his life. Are you allowed to be Mechal Shabbos for the fetus? Yes or no? Achlokas, always a good answer. We'll accept that. So let's turn to the Baal Halachos Gedolos. The Baal Halachos Gedolos says, the context here is whether you're allowed to violate Yom Kippur for health reasons. Ela afilu isha ubra, even a woman who is pregnant, v'adinan de'ilo achla misaker vlada. If she doesn't eat, she'll have a miscarriage. You are allowed to violate the laws of Yom Kippur, and by extension the laws of Shabbos, in order to preserve that fetus. Now why is that? What's the halachic basis for that? We just said you're allowed to violate Shabbos because bikuach nefesh, to save a soul. Is a fetus considered a halachic nefesh? Yes or no? So it depends when. So let me, the Mishnah says the following. The Mishnah in Nida says, the Mishnah in Olos says, if a woman is having difficulty during labor, we're talking the very end stages of the gestation, ninth month gestation, and her life is at risk, what's the halacha? The halacha is, and the Mishnah is very graphic, you can dismember the fetus limb by limb in order to save the life of the mother. What happens if the fetus's head exits the birth canal? Are you allowed to do anything to the fetus? Nothing. You can't touch the fetus. Why not? What does the Mishnah say? Because ein dochin nefesh mipnei nefesh. Implication being, and admittedly this is a long and complex sugya, and we're simplifying it for our discussion this evening, but the basic understanding is that prior to this fetus exiting the womb, it is not considered a nefesh. Only after it exits the womb, it's considered a full nefesh in the classic halachic sense. Now, prior to that, it may be a sub-nefesh, a pseudo-nefesh, whatever you want to call it, and there are big discussions, which we're not going to talk about this evening, about what the issur of abortion is, and it is by no means agreed upon. There's probably 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 opinions about what the potential prohibition is for abortion, and it's not a simple unanimous issue. So at this particular stage, the fetus is not considered nefesh. So I ask you again, you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos for Pikuach nefesh. So how can you violate Shabbos for a fetus? Fetus is not a nefesh. So the answer is, because a fetus is a potential nefesh. Not that it's an actual nefesh, it's a potential nefesh. And the principle which has been enunciated by the Rishonim is Chalel Alav Shabbos Achas Kadei Sheishmor Shabbosos Harbe. You violate one Shabbos for the preservation of this fetus in the hopes that it will be able to observe many Shabbosos in the future. So the halacha is yes, we violate Shabbos to preserve the fetus. Now let me ask you the next question. A fetus less than 40 days gestation in a mother's womb, are you allowed to violate Shabbos to preserve that fetus? Why not? What's the difference? So some of you might be familiar with this halachic principle, which is enunciated in a number of places in the Gemara, that less than 40 days of gestation, the fetus is considered maya ba'alma. One of those examples is here in your handout from the Gemara in Nida, Hamapelas liyomem, ena chasheshes levlad, that if a woman has a spontaneous miscarriage before 40 days, you're not concerned that a woman doesn't have to observe the tumah and tahara of birth because less than 40 days it's maya ba'alma. It's not a real fetus. So if that's the case, are you allowed in mechal Shabbos for a fetus less than 40 days or not? Yeah. So it's machlokas. So the Ramban paskins in this section. We'll start from the middle, Afilu Hachi, by number 45. Afilu Hachi le'inyin shmiras mitzvos mechalin alav, because Amra Torah chalal alav Shabbos achas shema yishmor Shabbos harbe, afhilkach, afilu b'hatzolas ubar pachos miben arboim yom, she'ein lo chiyus klal, mechalin alav kedas bal halachos. So according to the Ramban, based on the Bahag, which we mentioned before, yes, you are allowed to be mechal Shabbos for a fetus less than 40 days in a woman's womb, and I mentioned it, we won't do it inside, but I brought down the Tzitz Eliezer and who paskins that way, and most poskim generally paskin that way. You're allowed to be mechal Shabbos for a fetus less than 40 days in the mother's womb. So now, let's return to our stem cell issue. An embryo sitting in the laboratory in Tel Aviv. Electricity is off. If you don't intervene and you don't mechal Shabbos, these embryos will decompose. Are you allowed to violate Shabbos to preserve those embryos? Yes or no? Now these embryos, this is an interesting discussion which nobody really addresses fully. These embryos are indeed less than 40 days old, but they're in suspended animation less than 40 days old. They're not really, they're embryologically less than 40 days. They're not chronologically less than 40 days. They could be years. And this is another issue which will present itself in the decades and centuries to come. You have frozen embryos in the laboratory. It's possible that great-great-grandchildren could give birth to embryos that were created by their great-great-grandparents. Because these embryos could be frozen for decades, if not centuries. And the issues that these are going to present, we won't discuss this evening. So if you turn the page to the last page of your handout, some have cited this sentence, this pasuk in the Torah, and this is not obviously pure halacha, more for homiletical reasons, more for some support from the Chumash. The Chumash says, "Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam, damo yishafech." He who sheds the blood of a man within a man, his blood shall be shed. So, what is the Gemara says? What is a man within a man? How could you have a human being within a human being? That's a baby in a woman's womb. That's dam ha'adam ba'adam. That's a man within a man, or a being within a being. It does not say shofech dam ha'adam bepetri dish damo yishafech. So the implication here, and this is what many people paskin, and if you look at your handout on the upper right-hand corner, a letter from Rav Vosner, which appeared in a sefer called Chasdei Avraham. Now read from the underlined section, roughly five lines in, towards the end of the line. Aval gam elu shesovrim kanal. Hanutoch mem yom biyosi kvar muberes ve'anu matzilim chayi ubar she'asid liyos nefesh chayi. Even those who paskin, like we talked about, like the Ramban and the Baal Lachos Gedolos, that you can preserve, you can violate Shabbos to preserve a fetus in a woman's uterus less than 40 days of gestation. Aval lokein behazraschus. This is not the case for an embryo sitting in the laboratory. V'chiyaleh al adas davar hevel kazeh sheyemutil chal Shabbos al zera zeh shebechutz. Shita delo. Rav Vosner says, can you imagine allowing somebody to be mechal Shabbos for cells sitting in the laboratory? Absolutely, categorically not. And the general consensus amongst the poskim is that no, you are not allowed to be mechal Shabbos for the embryo in the laboratory. And why not? What's the difference between the embryo in the laboratory and the that's less than 40 days gestation and the fetus that's sitting in a woman's womb? What's the halachic difference? So the general distinction that the poskim mention is that in utero, if left undisturbed, this fetus has potential to become a human being. If you take these cells and leave them undisturbed, they have no potential to become a human being. They may indeed have genetic potential if you ask the scientists. Yes, they have the genes to become a human being. But if you ask the halachist, they don't meet the level of potential necessary in order to allow the violation of Shabbos. So no, you're not allowed to be mechal Shabbos. Does that mean that you can use these cells with impunity and you can do anything you want with them? You can discard them, you can play with them, you can burn them, you can do anything you want? So the answer is no. They still have a status beyond just simple matter. What is their status? What imbues them with this status? And here there's a bit of a debate and a bit of a machlokas. What imbues them with the status, at least according to some poskim, is the fact that they are still derivative from the reproductive seed of the human being. And there's a prohibition of hashchasa zera. There's a prohibition of the destruction of the reproductive seed, specifically the male reproductive seed. So since there's a prohibition against destruction, one should be cautious, one should be careful. And some have made distinctions in the following way. Yes, you can use cells, embryonic cells, for research if and only if they are destined for destruction. If they're not destined for destruction, if they're possibly destined for implantation, then you can't use those kinds of stem cells. And what scientists, and I'll just close in a minute and then we'll open up for questions, what scientists are now working on in order to circumvent some of the political and ethical issues that relate to stem cell research, there's a very exciting frontier. And this I'll ask you just to turn back for a moment to the English section, the very last paragraph on your English sheet, entitled Controversy-Free Stem Cells. Researchers have used altered nuclear transfer to generate pluripotent murine embryonic stem cells from blastocysts inherently unable to implant in the uterus. Translation. What that means is that scientists are creating embryonic stem cells that are physiologically unimplantable. They won't become human beings. It's impossible for them to become human beings. They're varying the embryo in such a fashion that it couldn't possibly grow and develop embryologically. And this, they believe, would solve the ethical dilemma. Because the ethical dilemma is you're taking potential human life and you're destroying it. If this embryo could never become human life, there should be no ethical reason not to destroy the embryo. Thereby you could circumvent the issue. But that is not so necessary for halacha. Because according to halacha, we don't consider the embryo an absolute human life in the sense that other religions do. Even the fetus in utero doesn't have a status of a full nefesh. Alachas kama v'kama, even more so, the embryo in the laboratory. That's why the general consensus amongst the poskim is that indeed it is permitted to use embryonic stem cells for research, with, as I mentioned, some kinds of limitations, varying limitations depending on the rabbanim that are involved. So in conclusion, just like to mention to you, the Gemara in Psachim mentions that Chizkiyo HaMelech did a number of things in his life without first asking the rabbi's approval. Some of them he received retrospective approval, really. And one of them was the Geniza of Sefer Refuos, the burying or destroying of a Sefer called Sefer HaRefuos. And according to Chazal, And according to Rashi in particular, not everybody agrees with this approach, but this is one approach about the understanding of Sefer Refuos. Sefer Refuos contained within it the cure to all human disease, such that no diseases would exist anymore if one consulted Sefer Refuos. So what happened? Why did Chizkiyahu feel compelled to bury a book which had cures to all human disease? So the answer is that people were using the book and were not turning their eyes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, were not turning their eyes to God, to realize that God is the origin of the universe. He is the one who creates disease. He is the one who cures disease. Just like the scientists at the joke that we said at the beginning. It is our hope that stem cell research will be a gradual exhumation of the Sefer Refuos. Perhaps with stem cell research, we'll be able to cure many of the diseases we discussed tonight. Diseases like diabetes, diseases like Parkinson's disease, and many such diseases. So hopefully, when someone stands here in Yeshiva College in Reuben Hall in 100 years from now and asks, has anybody here seen a case of diabetes? Has anybody here seen a case of Parkinson's disease? Hopefully no hands will go up. And Amir Tzachem will see this in our lifetimes. Thank you very much and be happy to answer any questions. Yes. Probably no difference, although, to be honest, there may be a difference. I'm glad you pointed this out, because I just want to clarify for a moment. You mentioned using these for cloning purposes. Now, one thing which I didn't mention here, which I should mention for you to understand, there's big debates about cloning, obviously, but the cloning debate is generally divided into two aspects. One aspect is called reproductive cloning. And in reproductive cloning, that's creating a clone for the purpose of producing a child, a living child who will indeed be a clone of the individual from whom they were harvested. The other type of cloning, which you're alluding to, which I mentioned also, is called therapeutic cloning. And that's cloning for the purpose of harvesting stem cells, which has been done already in Korea. Now, your point is well taken. If indeed there was an individual who would benefit directly from that cell line who had it, particular pikuach nefesh problem, then indeed you might be able to be mechal Shabbos in order to preserve those embryos or to preserve those cells which would be directly related. The nature of the how proximate the relationship would be between the chil Shabbos and the cure would have to be discerned in order to determine whether you'd be allowed to be mechal Shabbos or not. So for example, we've now determined in essence that stem cell research doesn't violate any halachic principles, or if it does, they can be circumvented in certain ways. If they did, let's say, for example, it was an Isser Drabanan or an Isser Deraisa, there's a prohibition to do stem cell research. Could one then say that I can do stem cell research because maybe I will, as a result, find a cure for diabetes? So the answer to that is no. Absolutely not. It does not meet the threshold for the violation of Isurim if the Pikuach Nefesh is not directly related to the research. So true, in 20, 30 years, or maybe 5 years or less time, cures may result from stem cell research, but if it was prohibited, one couldn't do it. And the classic example, which is applied to many of our discussions today in medical halacha, came from the 1700s, from the Tshuva of the Noda Behuda, talking about autopsy. They asked the Noda Behuda in the 1700s, can you do an autopsy on somebody who had an operation, and at that time it happened to have been a bladder stone. The person suffered from a bladder stone. He was operated on and died. And they asked the Noda Behuda, can we do an autopsy because maybe somebody else with a bladder stone will present to the doctors and will be able to better treat the patient. So the Noda Behuda said, no, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to violate the body, which requires burial, and there's a prohibition of desecration of the body and things like that, and this obviously relates to organ donation, unless there is a chola lefanenu, unless there is a sick person who will benefit directly and immediately from the procedure. If you say, oh, maybe in a week or two, a month or two, a year or two, so he said, you know, then you're really on the slippery slope. He says, if that's the case, then you could be Mechal Shabbos every single Shabbos because, you know, maybe somebody might get sick, so let me start, you know, doing this and writing this and tearing this and turning on that. So no, you have to have a real direct relationship in order to allow the any prohibitions. Yeah. Why would Hashchas HaZera not be a problem? Because it's not so clear whether the major prohibition is the emission of the Zera. Not so much once the Zera has been emitted that there's any major prohibition in discarding it. And if for sure if it's going to be discarded anyway, you may as well use it for something which could be of benefit to people. So for example, in the debates about abortion, the Chavis Yoyer is really the only person who says the prohibition of abortion is Hashchas HaZera, because the embryo contains the male reproductive seed. But not everybody holds like that. It's not an agreed upon.
Rabbi Shuri spoke about the beneficent aspect of adult embryonic placental stem cell research, but he never really mentioned the maleficent aspect of the carcinogenic effect on people if you use it for therapeutic cloning.
I don't understand.
The carcinogenic effect of once you put it in, you can't really stop it from reproducing.
So what he's alluding to is really, it's a scientific question. How safe is the use of this technology? If you start implanting stem cells into people, then are these cells going to be uncontrolled now and generate cancer? And the answer to that is...
What would the rabbis say? Because it's very dangerous.
What would the rabbis say is the question? The rabbis would say, wait until the scientists figure it out. That's exactly what they would say. And if scientists determine that it's safe, then we would say it's okay. And this is the whole issue of how much risk you're allowed to incur in the field of research, in the field of clinical medicine. So cloning also, for example, you could argue that while cloning, we talked about Hashchas HaZera, we talked about destruction of the male reproductive seed. Interestingly, cloning has halachic advantages. The halachic advantage of cloning is that you don't need male reproductive seed at all. You just need an adult cell. You can use a cheek cell, you can use a skin cell, you can use a bladder cell, you can use any cell you want. So cloning to produce stem cells is actually less halachically complicated than harvesting male reproductive seed. But the cloning procedure itself is still deemed by scientists to be very complicated and have great risk for the clone. The sheep Dolly, for example, died at a premature age. And there's a lot of unanswered questions. And they have to go through countless hundreds of times of cloning deformed fetuses until it actually produced a clone. So yes, it is dangerous, and it might not meet the threshold of safe enough for rabbis to allow. And that enters into the discussion and has to be reassessed and reevaluated as the science progresses. Yes?
Are there any known long-term disadvantages to stem cell development?
The question is, are there any long-term disadvantages to stem cell development? We haven't reached the long-term yet. When we reach the long-term, we'll be able to know, and that's the way science evolves. There's lots of things which look very promising, and who knows? I mean, I'd like to think that in 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 20 years from now, we'll be able to see a lot of advantages to stem cell research, but who knows? Stem cell research might be found to be too dangerous, and it might be dropped. That's how science evolves. We keep trying and banging down the door and pushing farther and farther, and if things reveal themselves that it subsequently is a bad idea, then we'll reverse. So the question is, would there be a halachic issue with using animal cells in this kind of research? Now, there have been animal organ transplants. So there has been a baboon heart transplant. There have been animal bone marrow transplants. And the term is xenotransplant, which is transplant from something other than the human being, in this particular case, the animal kingdom. And the Food and Drug Administration is actually working on studies. And interestingly, the animal which is found to be the most compatible for organ transplant for the human being is the pig. The pig heart is the most compatible. So what's the halachic issue of A, using animal organs for transplant, B, using animal reproductive material to introduce into the human being? Now these are the kinds of questions that poskim are only beginning to allude to. This is truly the frontier of medicine and the frontier of halacha. And the challenge, whereas we've had many other challenges in the previous centuries, in the previous millennia, our challenge in this next century is going to be to define the essence of the human being. I just read a very fascinating article talking about how do you define Jewish genes? You know, we talk about Jewish genetics and the Ashkenazi Jewish genetic diseases. At what stage is a human being considered Jewish? So, for example, if you have a person who starts out Jewish and you transplant his heart, his kidneys, his livers, his lungs, his bone marrow, and he has more than 50% of his body comes from non-Jewish sources, that person's still Jewish. If you have an animal cell that's introduced into your body, is that person therefore part animal? Can you count that person as part of a minion? Maybe he can't be considered part of a minion. If you kill him, are you chayav misa? Is it homicide? Maybe it's not. Maybe just kill. Maybe shechita. Maybe you have to sheft them. These are the kind of questions that we're going to be forced to deal with as you have these chimeras, the meldings of animal cells and different human beings. So now you can splice genes. You know, we're talking about definition of motherhood and definition of fatherhood. You could splice genes from 5 different people to create sperm. So who's the father of the child? So these are the shilas we're going to have to answer. We might have to redefine them, or we might have to maintain them as a suffix.
You call Robert White at the end.
Right. Right, so Rabbi Blatt's position, he's one of the dissenting positions, is that the stem cell still has, and mostly because of the Hashchasa Zera issue, still has a status that he doesn't differentiate whether it's inside the womb or outside the womb. It still has the potential halachic yisurim of the destruction of the embryo, whether it's inside the womb or outside the womb.
I'd just like to thank Dr. Reichman for coming here today and speaking to us. Actually, as you mentioned about PGD and abortion, those are actually 2 things that are coming up. PGD is possibly going to even be this semester in the coming weeks. So if you can please, there are sheets going around. You can sign your name and email so we can reach you and tell you about future events. Thank you again, Dr. Reichman.
Thank you. autopsies. One of the things that they found in the autopsies is that it's not the thing that Marinos, so to speak, for medicine, that they're finding. It's not something, the more autopsies you do, the better we understand the disease, the better in quality. No, they're better able to understand, did this person die from dementia, or did he have multiple strokes that caused dementia?
Right, this is a long-standing debate, and these articles are written by, I read the article.
Right.
And this is written by pathologists.
Right.
Who are defending their profession, and they're basically saying that you'll be better doctors if you understand what this person you treated died from, and you'll be able to treat them better. The question is, even if that's true, still doesn't meet the threshold. The only way it would meet the threshold is if you had, you know, let's say the Hazanish mentions, if you have an epidemic and you have people that are sick with this particular
disease. The sentence that I jumped out of me is, oh my gosh, this can change things, was where they said that now they have to decide how do they treat the brothers and the sisters. Do they put them on watch for dementia? Do they put them on, start giving them
so much workup is done while people are alive. You know, everybody's getting their CAT scans in their eyes, and they know about the dementia, you know, beforehand. Very few, if any, of these cases that are
so
really
what, what, when I read the article, so I gave it to my shop.
But it won't change the general law.
There were sentences in there that I thought weighed a lot. I mean, I don't know if they were accurate. I can't promise you that he's the only post that when it comes to medical pathology. But the way he was saying things, it looked like...
He made a compelling argument.
He made a very compelling argument,
but it's not generally accepted by that much. It used to be like when I trained in medicine... I read the article and I know exactly what you're talking about. When I trained in medicine, hospitals had to have much higher percentage of their deaths go to the autopsy table. And you couldn't be accredited
if you didn't have
a certain number of autopsies. They gave incentives at least to get books and things like that if you would be able to get out of these problems, whether we could actually, you know, ask people for autopsies. But now it's not the case anymore. We do so much, you know, imaging of the body while alive.
So, you know, the way you were phrasing it is the colon de Panenu. So they had the colon de Panenu. That was the part that was.
It's kind of a stretch. You know, whether you should do testing on the child possibly, or the sibling possibly falling into disease later on, it's not the same as an active colon. It's still an element of potential, statistical analysis.
Okay, so you find the article.
I enjoyed it, but it definitely could force you to reanalyze the issue, but I think if I reanalyze it, still would not radically change it.
Too small of a
thing. Right, I'm already got it.
Yeah. My email.
I think you're the best person to get info from.
Yeah, we just wanted to get it. Okay,
very good.
Thank you very much.
Also, just about the Shukazela cell part, if a Jewish couple wanted to harvest, produce an embryo just for the sake of, say, saving their child and destroying the embryo by utilizing the stem cells.
That's a good question. Now, where we stand now in 2005, if they wanted to produce an embryo for stem cell research, it wouldn't justify a Shvasa Zera. If, for the sake of discussion, let's say, and this technology hasn't reached this point yet, if for the sake of discussion they had a child who suffered from a medical condition, and them creating an embryo and harvesting the stem cells could directly treat that child, then you might meet the threshold and might indeed be permitted to do.
Okay.
But that child hasn't been asked yet because it hasn't become a real case yet.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
No, they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're not.
No,
they're
not.
No,
they're
not.
No,
they're
not.
Take some food. So no, much. There's nothing left. There's no meat. We talk about the food too soon. Meat? We just took it out. Whoa.
Where?
On the table. On the back door.
Medical.